amended the title of the dissertation, of the presentation, since it was submitted several months ago. Now it's called Eschatology, Temple, and the Interpretation of the Prophecy: Philosophical Parallels and Differences Between the Teaching of Adventism, Judaism, and Mainstream Christianity. Sort of similar, but I just refocused because we won't have enough time to discuss the issue of coming of the Messiah in a big detail because of the limitation of the time. Do Sabbath and dietary laws represent the only parallels between the doctrinal teaching of Judaism and the Seventh-day Adventists? It seems that after the publication of Anthony Hoyer-Kammer's Four Major Cults, where the book was published in the early 60s, where the Seventh-day Adventists were labeled as a non-Christian Judaizers and legalists, Adventists became a little bit scared to emphasize its parallels between Judaism. In the area of eschatology and prophetic interpretation, Adventists always trace their heritage and emphasize their connection with the mainstream Christian reformers. However, does any connection or parallel exist between the Adventism and Judaism in the area of eschatology and prophetic interpretation? This paper is an attempt to make a brief comparison between some points in the Adventist and Jewish systematic theology. One of the challenges of this research is to define the sources for Jewish systematic theology, especially when it deals with the issues pertaining to eschatology and prophecy. The famous Reform rabbi Stephen Weiland says that the primary concern of the Jews was to live earthly life according to the Torah. Rabbis were more interested in defining the halakha than in defining the details of the teaching that has no immediate practical application. However, in spite of such strict pragmatic nature of rabbinic Judaism, agadic genre in rabbinic literature presents the wide variety of views and opinions on the other subjects. Well, you may hear a little bit of the terminology. I don't know. Are you familiar with the term Agada? That's, I'll explain. There are two genres in rabbinic literature: the halachic genre, which deals with the law, and the agadic genre, which deals with the interpretation of the Bible and the Jewish history. So Agada can be found in different rabbinic documents, mainly in different collections of Midrashim, and also in the Babylonian and Palestinian Talmuds. In the later period of the history of rabbinic Judaism, different rabbis and scholars attempted to create some theological system of Jewish teaching. This was done in a context of the Jewish-Christian-Muslim debates, which were held in the period from 9th to 11th century. And I will touch on this later in more details. But it was a very good time. And interestingly enough, one of the center for such a Jewish-Christian-Muslim dialogue and discussion on a doctrinal issue, especially in the 9th and 10th century, was the city of Baghdad under the time of the rulership of the Caliph Umayyad. Isn't it strange? But We'll talk about this. In the Jewish history, this period is called Geonic. And we'll use this terminology because Geonim were the heads of the rabbinic academies where they studied the Talmud. But before we go into the Geonim, we'll touch on some earlier rabbinic material. This brief research will present and analyze sample excerpts from a different rabbinic and post-rabbinic documents which contain the opinions of the leading rabbis and scholars on the subject of on the following subjects: the controversy between God and Satan, the heavenly sanctuary, the Yerday principle, and the historical interpretation of the prophecy. Interesting, isn't it? We can all find it in Judaism. So let's start with the simple stuff. The controversy between God and Satan. Unfortunately, we cannot find many references to the Satan in rabbinic literature, but that one is especially interested. This reference is found in Midrash called Tanhuma. This document is dated by the second half of the 9th century. It is essentially a running commentary on the entire five books of Moses, sort of like a type of a, if you, you know, pulpit commentary. So it's, it contains a lot of homiletic material. And what it does when it contains the homiletic material, it inserts into the text of the scripture different stories. Well, these stories, of course, are not a part of the Bible, but they definitely tell us what the rabbis actually believe. So these stories are very, very important. Particularly, we are interested in a story in the Agadic story, which is found in the commentary on the Genesis 22, the famous Akedah narrative. Akedah means the binding of Isaac. So we have Abraham, you know the verse. We have God saying to Abraham, "Abraham, take your son, your beloved son, and go up to the Mount Moriah and offer him as a sacrifice on one of the mountains, which I will show you." We know that text. So as a response, verse 3, Abraham wakes up in the morning, picks up the wood and a knife and takes Isaac with him and takes a couple servants. And then the next verse is going to be 3 days later. The rabbis are smart because they know where Abraham lived. From that area to the Mount Moriah is not a 3 days. So the rabbis are interested. What were they doing during this three-day journey? Why did it take them so long time? So that's how the story, the Agadic story, explaining the possible reason why was the delay is inserted. In this story, the Satan appears to Abraham in the likeness of an old man. And he says, Abraham, where are you going? Oh, I'm going to pray. But why do you have a knife? Well, we're going to be there for a while, and we may hunt some animal and eat it. Well, just a short of it, then the Satan says to Abraham, I was there when the Holy One, blessed be He, said to you, take your son, and now the old man like you will go and destroy the son that was given to him at the age of 100. Did not you hear the parable that the one who destroys what he had in his hand has to beg from others? And if you will say that another son will be given to you, then you will listen to the rebellious one. Interesting point here. The usage of the term in Tanhuma is mastin. Mastin is, how do I explain it better? The Hebrew word hasatan, Satan, comes from the verb lehastin, to rebel. So the Satan is saying it's not God who is telling you to offer your son. It is some kind of a bad guy, you know, a gangster, mastin. It was the mastin who told you to destroy the son, and you will destroy the soul and will be liable for it in the final judgment. Can you hear some parallels? The Satan talking to Abraham. And Abraham rejects Satan's proposition, saying, I wasn't listening to any mastin, but to the Holy One, blessed be He. So Satan departs from Abraham and appears to Isaac in the likeness of a young man and says to him, O unfortunate, the son of unfortunate, how many fasts your mother fasted before she delivered you? And now this old crazy man is going to slaughter you. Isaac replies, even though so, I will not transgress the decree of my Creator and the command of my father. Do you see the tension here between the commandment of God, the God, and the Satan, how it was portrayed? That is interesting. At the end, God informs us that after Abraham has had his experience on the top of the Mount Moriah, I skipped the story, which is also interesting there, the Satan gets very disappointed that the will of God was carried out and Isaac is spared. So he rushes back to Sarah and he tells Sarah everything what happened upon the Mount Moriah. And Sarah gets so shocked that she can't bear it, and she dies. And that's how the rabbis explain why suddenly after Genesis 22, this story, and Genesis 23 starts with the information about the death of Sarah. But this little insertions, you know, you may believe them or you may not believe them, but they illustrate a very interesting point. The rabbis are aware about the great controversy between God and Satan. In fact, some scholars even suggested that the parallels between the Satan's temptation in a desert story in the Gospel of Matthew and Luke and the story of Satan trying to tempt Abraham. So this is a sort of easy parallel. I can say talking about the mainstream Christianity, that mainstream Christianity, we know, I don't have to cite sources, does possess in some way or another the teaching about the great controversy. But I included the great controversy motive here because it is one of the fundamental part, the foundational part, a motive of the book of Revelation. Now, sanctuary in heaven. Several decades ago, some Adventist scholars began the debate on the reality and literality of the heavenly sanctuary. Roy Adams, in his dissertation published in 1980, The Doctrine of the Sanctuary in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, Three Approaches, demonstrates the logical difficulties some may encounter dealing with the issues of the literal sanctuary in heaven. The question of the reality of the sanctuary in heaven plays a key role in the understanding and interpretation of the book of Revelation. In the early 1960s, an Israeli scholar, Avigdor Avtobitzer, published the extensive research on the issue of heavenly temple in rabbinic literature. I think it was the excerpt from his doctoral dissertation in Hebrew University, which was published in the magazine Tarbitz in Hebrew. He stated that it is absolutely clear in Agada that the temple exists in heaven and that the earthly temple is made in the image of heavenly one. Here is one Agada, also from, happened to be found in Tanhuma. That's the commentary on the weekly Torah portion called Nassau, which was actually studied last week. That's on Exodus 25. And they shall, and you shall build me a sanctuary, and I will dwell among you. Here what the commentator, it's a little bit different genre. There is no story here, but it's just a comment. That's what the commentator says. Come and see. When the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses to command the sons of Israel to make Him the sanctuary, the Holy One, blessed be He, said to Moses, tell the sons of Israel that I am not ordering to build the sanctuary for me because I have no place to live. For the universe was not created until the temple in high was erected, until the temple was erected in heaven. For it is written, the throne of the glory on high from the beginning, Jeremiah 17:12, and there the temple of my throne is built, as it is written, in the temple of his holiness, Habakkuk 2:20. The other source, which is interesting, is the Targum, the Aramaic translation of the Hebrew scripture, particularly Targum Jonathan on the prophets, and the translation of the book of Isaiah, chapter 6, verses 1, 2, and 6. You know the story, how Isaiah sees God upon a throne, and it says Ram Venisa, high and elevated, sort of. And here, what the Meturgaman translator, and in Targumim, especially in Targum Yonatan, there is always the translation intertwined with the commentative inserts. Hear what it says. That the throne and even the altar from which the coals were taken descended from heaven. This interpretation of Isaiah 6 resembles the famous comment of Ellen White in the book Prophets and Kings, where she writes about God's heavenly sanctuary descending from above to support the prophet. That's the comment on the same chapter. According to Afterbitzer, the earthly sanctuary is built in accordance to the heavenly, and its services mirror the ones held at the temple in heaven. For the Adventists, this is a very important point. Even though they may disagree with the fact that in heavenly sanctuary the sacrifices would take place, this disagreement is only in the minor details. Because Adventists believe that the altar of the heavenly sanctuary is situated on earth. As for the service that occurs in the inner compartment, this was the foundational discovery which led Adventist pioneers out of the great disappointment. The logic of Agada is plain. If there is a temple in heaven, this temple in heaven should be located also in the heavenly Jerusalem. The Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Tanit, the Fasting, page 71, side A, contains one of the many mentioning of heavenly Jerusalem. Thus said Rabbi Yochanan, "The Holy One, blessed be He, said, I will not enter the Jerusalem above until I come into Jerusalem below." So you see the upper Jerusalem and lower Jerusalem here mentioned. Could this be that the concept employed by John the Revelator about the heavenly Jerusalem was circulating in the oral form in the rabbinic tradition as far back as the time of Jesus? In any case, the motive of the heavenly sanctuary encompasses the entire book of Revelation. Could that be that at the time of writing of this book, around 90 AD, God wanted John to direct the attention of the Jews who were in disarray because of the recent destruction of the temple toward the heavenly, indestructible temple that was known at this time? Could that be that the seven golden lamps John sees in his opening vision represented the heavenly menorah, as opposed to the earthly one taken by Titus at the destruction of Jerusalem as a trophy to Rome? Interestingly enough, even today, talking about the heavenly Jerusalem, the rabbis have an interesting explanation for the keeping of some prayers in the prayer books, in the Jewish liturgy service. For example, before the reciting of Shema prayer, the famous text from Deuteronomy, "Hear, O Israel," there is a short saying. It was a short piyut, the liturgical poem, which is called Ahava. And here it says, "Bring us with upright pride, with our uprightness back into our land." Also, at the Passover, the end of the Seder is always saying, "Lashana ba b'Yerushalayim," next year in Jerusalem. Well, if you come today to Jerusalem, they will say, "Next year in Jerusalem." Why would they say, "Next year in Jerusalem"? Aren't you already in Jerusalem? The rabbi today explains very plainly, we are not satisfied with the earthly Jerusalem. We know that there is a bigger, greater Jerusalem waiting for us. And that is the main thrust of our benedictory saying next year in Jerusalem. In any case, it is hard to overlook the fact that at the time when mainstream evangelicals talk less and less about the heavenly sanctuary, and at the time when Eastern Orthodox Christianity starting from John Chrysostom, insists that Jerusalem Temple was a predecessor of modern Orthodox Cathedral. And at the time when numerous early and medieval Orthodox commentators used Hebrew 9 to establish the fact that heavenly sanctuary is just the parable, using the Greek words skia and parabolia, Jewish Agada unanimously talk about the existence of the real heavenly sanctuary. Avtobitzer is not the only Jewish scholar who advocates the heavenly sanctuary. David Noel Friedman is one of the chief editors of the Anchor Bible Commentary. In his explanation, in his commentary of the book on the book of Amos, explains the phrase from chapter 9, verse 6, "Who builds his upper chambers in heaven and found his vault upon the earth." He affirms that without the Jewish tradition, that without a doubt, Jewish tradition upholds that the earthly temple is built after the image of the heavenly one. And I can continue on and on, especially talking about the issue of the rituals, the understanding of a scapegoat, for which Hoyakama blasts at the Seventh-day Adventists and accuses them being pro-Jewish cult. And in fact, it is true. I don't know any Christian's denomination today which officially has the explanation that the scapegoat typifies the Satan. And this is what in Milgram's commentary on Leviticus, when he blasts at the number of Christian scholars, saying that commentators go against the common sense. No single Jew would ever, in any healthy mind, even suspect and think that the scapegoat could, the goat for Azazel, could point out to the Messiah. What about the year-day principle and the principles of prophetic interpretation? I have a couple more minutes. I'll be very brief. We move into the next period of rabbinic literature, and we touch on the very important rabbi, the Gaon, the chief of rabbinic academy in Baghdad. His name was Saadia. Saadia lived at the time when in Judaism there was a period of a Karaite schism. The group of the Jews decided to abandon any oral tradition. Therefore, Saadia decides to write the important book, the Sefer Emunot Vedaot, the book of doctrines and beliefs, where he uses philosophical method to present the doctrines of Judaism. This is the first, I would say, systematic exposition of the Jewish beliefs to the public. And he has a chapter about the coming of the Messiah. And particularly, hear how he talks about the coming of the Messiah. We don't have the time for this, but I'll say that the key text through which Saadia uses to give a hint about the approximate time of the coming of the Messiah is actually Daniel chapter 12. Here he says, thereupon he explained to him that the period would be one of 1335 years. And he did this in his statement. Happy is he that waiteth and cometh to the 1,305 days, Daniel 12:12. What's important here is this. The term days in this sentence stands for the cycle of the years. In a scriptural statement, days shall he have for its redemption. Do you notice the logic? Uses a little bit different text, but the logic is the same as the Adventist pioneers use. I will skip the rest of the citation, but Saadia understands very clearly. Time, you know, of course he doesn't have the book of Revelation, so he gets to Daniel 12, that's the last eschatology for him. But Daniel 7, time times half a time. Well, he understands it as years. Of course, he makes a mistake and thinks that this is the same as 1335 days in Daniel 12, but this is another story I wanted just to point out to the bottom line, that since Saadia, Judaism, if it in any way or form attempts to interpret the prophecy, uses only prophetic day-year period, and never in any Jewish literature or tradition we find any of the period in Daniel as the literal days. Never. Even at the sticking point of 70-week prophecy, they try to go this way and that way and out and around, but they will not abandon the day-year principle, which to me shows that the tradition goes way back into the early times. Otherwise, they would have much easier time to disprove their Christian opponents by just rejecting the day-year principle. But they don't dare try to do this. And the last point I want to make very briefly is Maimonides. Maimonides sort of lives a couple hundred years later in Muslim Cordova, Spain, and he is writing a letter to the Jewish community of Yemen trying to explain the issues with the coming of the Messiah. And here how he writes, based on Saadia, the last passage I read. This was predicted by the divinely inspired prophet Daniel, according to whom, in some future time it would happen, sometime later, a person will appear with a religion similar to true one, as it is written in the following verse. I considered the horns, and behold, another little horn came among them, before which the three of the first horns were plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the human and the mouth speaking big things. This obviously alludes to a person who will found a new religion similar to a divine religion and make claim to revelation and to prophecy. This will produce much talk and endeavor to alter the Torah and abolish it, as he states. He shall seek to change the season and the law. I was very brief reading this, but the bottom line of the entire chapter of his epistle is to say that there is some form of the false Christianity which changes the days and the laws, and the Messiah should come after Roman, and then after, he points out, that there will be the false Christianity and Islam. So you can see, even though he says a certain person, but he talks very plainly as a historicist more than a futurist, applying Daniel 7:25 to the current prophetic events. Well, maybe it's a time for us to stop shying away from our roots. Maybe it's a time for us to rethink, especially in our fundamental beliefs, which makes us different from the rest of the mainstream Christianity, to think where our connection, where else our connection can be found. I will end up my presentation with another statement from the 13th fundamental belief in Judaism, actually produced by Maimonides in another book. The 13th item says, with the perfect faith, I anticipate the coming of the Messiah. And even if he delays, I will still wait, because every day brings his approach near. Would you say amen to that?
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International copyright 2007. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.